Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. New York Times bestselling author Carolyn Leavitt returns with a story about mothers and daughters, guilt and innocence, and the lengths we go for love. Could you forgive a person who committed a crime? Could you forgive an attempted murderer? Would you trust an overworked legal system to decide your fate? Who decides if someone gets to have a clean slate and when? These are the questions at the heart of Leavitt's latest novel, Days of Wonder. 15-year-old Ella confesses to a crime she doesn't remember committing and faces both a life-changing prison sentence and an unplanned pregnancy. Ella is released from prison after serving only 6 years and is desperate to turn the page on a new life, but she can't seem to let go of her past. Leavitt is the acclaimed author of Cruel, Beautiful World, With or Without You, and the New York Times bestselling Pictures of You. Again, the latest is Days of Wonder, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Carolyn Leavitt back to this week's book show. How are you?
I'm great. I'm thrilled to see you again. You ask the best questions.
You're very sweet. Thank you very, very much. I remember when you started telling me that you were working on this particular novel, and I'm curious as to what brought you to this idea of someone who really their fate is somewhat decided so early in their life and then really gets a second chance.
Well, it happened two ways. So the first way was that when I was writing Cruel, Beautiful World, I was writing a lot about the Mansons. And I remember one thing that struck me was that Charlie Manson always said, if they let him out of prison, he would do the same thing again. He hadn't changed at all. Then I was thinking about Leslie Van Houten, one of the Manson girls, who had committed a crime when she was a young girl, but she changed herself. She got an education in jail. She helped other prisoners. And it was very strange to me that people could not see her for who she was now, years and years later, and they still associated her with that 17-year-old girl who was terrible. So once I had this, I was having dinner with a friend of mine, a woman I had known for a few years who I really liked. And she said, Caroline, I have to tell you something. And I thought, oh boy, here it comes. And she said, I committed a murder when I was 15. And yes, I did it. So I was sort of shocked, but I didn't say anything. She told me when she was 15, she was like, you know, she was wild. She was one of these cars without brakes. She was doing some drugs. She was just wild. And she did it. She committed a murder and she went to prison. And while she was in prison, she changed. And she became very, very sad about what she had done. She was determined to remake her whole identity. And she did. She was such a great inmate that she was let out early. She moved out of the country where she was. She changed her name. She took on a new profession and was really, really successful at it. And she became the kind of person that people loved her. I mean, I loved her. She was just kind and nice and wonderful. The only thing about her was that you couldn't get too intimate with her because, you know, there were certain walls she put up. So she was living her life until she was 40 years old when somebody found out about her and they outed her. She lost her job. She lost friends. She lost relationships. She lost everything. And she was totally broken apart because she said, why do people think I'm that 15-year-old girl when I've worked all these years so, so hard to be an adult woman who is completely different? And she went about reinventing herself again. And she, I was just fascinated by it. And I wanted to write her story, but I didn't want to invade her privacy. So we talked about it a little, and I made a promise to her that I would never reveal her name, and I would never reveal any details so anybody could find her or know anything about her, and that I would change the story totally. And that's what I did.
We have Ella, 15 years old, and she is head over heels in love with Jude. Jude's father is a very stern judge. And what I found interesting is they're 15, and yet it is a very adult relationship.
Yeah, it is. It's part of that is because, I mean, I was wildly in love when I was 15, and I had a nervous breakdown over it. And also it's because Ella's mom really wanted the household filled with family. So she let Jude live with the family. She considered him her son. She loved the two of them together. And they really gave each other what the other person needed. So they had plans for the future, which were not stupid plans. There were plans like, well, you know, you'll run a garden and I forget what she was going to do in the beginning. I'll write and we'll have a family and we'll do this. They had very specific ideas of how their life was going to be. And when you're that age, you think that's the truth. That's what's going to happen and nothing can break you apart.
There is a beautiful moment where Helen, who's Ella's mom, welcomes Jude into the house and he's interested in gardening and gives him a plot of land to grow flowers and vegetables, and he does. And the relationship between Helen and Jude is almost as interesting as the relationship between Ella and Jude.
Yeah, I wanted it to be that way. I wanted it to be for Helen. Jude was the son she never had, another child that she could take care of. He also talked to her. He showed her interest. They did the same things together. And the fact that he was so appreciative that she gave him this garden, and he was so appreciative and loved her house, which is kind of, you know, messy and hard scrabble. They did a lot for each other, and he in turn loved it that he was this mother figure who felt he was wonderful, who wasn't criticizing him. So it was kind of like this trio of a family, Jude, Helen, and her daughter, and they were all, you know, a family unit, which was what they all initially wanted.
And it became a haven because, as we learn, Jude is being abused at home by his father. Abuse and violence is very much a part of Jude's story.
Yeah, because when Jude was a little boy, his mother was teaching him to drive just as a lark. And they got in an accident and the mother died. And the father, who absolutely adored his wife, he didn't know how to make sense of it. So he blamed his son. And that went into drinking, and after the drinking, he would pummel his son, and he would always feel bad and buy him things and say, it'll never happen again, it'll never happen again, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And of course, it always happened again.
And there's also that dynamic between the two families where Jude comes from money, where Ella does not.
Right, exactly. I've lived in New York or around New York a long time, and it's very different. It's very, very different. I mean, before I got married, I had a boyfriend who was extremely wealthy, and he lived on the Upper East Side, and it just felt like a whole different place to me, and I always sort of felt out of place there. And I remember I mentioned it once to his mother, and his mother said, well, that's because you need me to take you shopping so you can look properly and act properly. And it was a real demarcation. It was definitely a difference between the classes that neither one wanted to cross over.
And it's very clear from Jude's father, from the judge, that he doesn't think much of Ella, and she is definitely not of that class, and they are too young. He says that over and over again, you're too young to be doing this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he always says you're too young, but mostly he's afraid because, you know, she doesn't come from money. She comes from a mother who doesn't have the greatest reputation. Yeah, you know, she's a young girl who lives in Bay Ridge, which somebody who lived on the Upper East Side would definitely look down upon. And he doesn't want that for a son. He wants his son to be a doctor, a lawyer, or, you know, to marry properly, to have the whole life. And that's not what his son wants.
Carolyn Levitt is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is Days of Wonder. It is published by Algonquin. I thought it was an interesting choice because, as often happens in young love, that a child comes into the equation. That does happen here. But it doesn't happen until after a crime is committed. And so it doesn't muddy the waters between the relationship between Jude and Ella. It comes after Ella is arrested and put away for murder.
Right. Yeah, I didn't want it to be a story about, oh, the kids are pregnant. What are we going to do? The rich father will take the child and there'll be visitation. I wanted it to be much more mysterious with stuff that you don't know. Where here's this girl and she's in prison and everybody's telling her something else. And all she knows is that she can't keep this daughter and she doesn't know where Jude is. And her mother keeps telling her, best thing to do is give the child up. That's the best thing. You can move on. And she's worn down. It's the same as when you're in a police office and they're asking you the same questions over and over again. And you just want them to stop. So you say, okay, do it. I just thought that was much more interesting because it takes her a while to, when she's out of prison, to start thinking about how things happened and why didn't she say something or why didn't she do whatever. And it was because she was a kid. She's a kid. She's 15.
And it's such a surprise when she is in prison and then learns that she's pregnant and the other women rally around her as well.
I spoke to a lot of women who were on probation, and I told them that I wanted to get the story right of what would happen. And the first thing they said to me was, I hope you're not going to write Orange is the New Black because we hate that show. And I said, no, I'm not. I want to know. And they told me that there's a kind of culture in women's prisons, or at least in Framingham Prison where they were, where the women were very kind to each other, especially when there were children involved. One person's child was everybody's child, and they were deeply sympathetic about that. And I thought that was kind of lovely, and I wanted to write about it because they understood. They had kids taken away from them too, and they didn't always get to see their kids on visiting days. So they were very, very sympathetic towards her.
I don't want to risk giving too much away, but there is the question of what happens to the child when the child is taken away from Ella, which there's a conversation, and really Ella isn't even a part of that.
Right. She's not a part of the conversation. The conversation is what's the best for the child and supposedly what's the best for Ella, and other people are deciding what's the best for her, which is it's best for you to just forget all about it. But the thing is, you can't, and she can't, and because there's so many questions she doesn't know the answers to. And when she wants to find her daughter, it isn't that I didn't want it to seem like, oh, I'm going to go get my daughter and kidnap her and it's going to be my life. I wanted it to be much more nuanced where I just want to see her. I just need to see her and make sure she's okay. And then, you know, then other things develop.
The book starts off with Ella getting out of prison, and we learn about the relationship between Ella and her mother, Helen. And Helen just seems like the dream mom, right? I mean, she's trying to do everything she can for her daughter, who she realizes was in this awful position, and now has a second chance.
She does, because Helen's whole upbringing was very restrictive. Helen was booted out of her home when she got pregnant by a rape, and she was determined that her daughter was going to have all the freedoms that she never had. And later when Ella was arrested, she began to think, did I give her too much freedom? Like, what kind of a mother am I? And Helen's whole thing is she wants connection. She just wants to be with her daughter, like us against the world. But the thing is, when people grow up and when Ella becomes a real adult, it can't be that way. You know, she's got to have her own life. She can still love and need her mother, but she still has to have her own life. And that's what created problems.
It does create problems. I've said this before, Carolyn, but if I live to be 150 years old, I'll probably never understand the mother-daughter relationship. But this is where the mother seems to be doing everything right, and Ella obviously has had issues here, but is just not hearing any of it.
Yeah, no, she's not hearing any of it because she's a kid and she's growing up and she wants to. It's important, especially I don't have a daughter. I have a son, but I've heard from my friends with daughters that the daughters have to pull away. They have to. They can adore you, but they have to say, no, your way is not my way. Don't tell me what to do. I'm going to do my own thing. And it's crushing for the mother, especially if the mother feels like, well, what did I do? I've always been this great mother. I've given you everything. Why are you being like this? And I don't know what the solution is, except maybe time.
Time is a factor in the novel, as Ella goes to try to find her child and goes from New York to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And that's when the novel starts to bring us to different times, different places, different perspectives, which is a fascinating way of telling the story. And I'm hoping you can talk to us a little bit about what that was like and the way you decided to tell the story through those various lenses.
It nearly killed me. It really nearly killed me. It was the first time I ever used a dual timeline. There's like two consecutive stories. One is the story from, you know, what happened that night with Jude and Ellen and the mother. And then the other story is set in present day with, you know, Ella's adult in Ann Arbor. And I must have mapped it out a million times. I put it all in Post-its over my wall to try to get it to come. And it was so, so hard. And I had to get a lot of writers to help me because I couldn't figure out how to do it. So it would seem sort of seamless. But it was really important to me that I wanted three different perspectives on what happened the night of the attempted murder, three different points of view, because I think that if everybody has a different point of view, then the attempted murder becomes different for every person, and the ramifications of that become different. So I put it into three parts. The first part is Ella tells what happened the night of the murder, what she remembers, which isn't a lot. Then about at the middle of the book, Jude tells what he remembers, and it's not a lot. And then at the end, there's one more character who tells what happened, and then you realize, and it changes everything that you thought you knew before from the other things. And I thought that was really interesting. It was really fun to write.
I also thought it was interesting that the very natural reason that there is so much confusion as to what happened and there is so little memory of what happened is because these are two characters aren't on drugs, aren't drunk, they haven't slept. They haven't slept in days and days and days, and they are completely deprived of sleep, and they don't know what they're bouncing into.
Yeah, I did a lot of research on sleep deprivation, and it's so interesting because you start to hallucinate, and very soon after you're not sleeping, it's really, really bad for your body. And I like that issue where they kept saying, we can't sleep. We have to stay awake. If we go to sleep, we'll lose each other. And the more they stay awake, the more everything gets muddy. And you just can't remember. And the things you remember may not even be real.
I don't want to leave the character of Helen without asking you about her backstory. In coming from an Hasidic background, which I thought was really interesting. You tease us a bit with it. You don't delve too much into it, but it does give you that it's a very strict background that she too was dealing with as a child.
Yeah. Now my own mom grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family, which is different than Hasidic. And my mother just loved the whole community until her dad died, and then she didn't. But she always yearned for it. So I wanted something deeper that was Hasidic. So I went out into Williamsburg with the people are very, very polite, but they don't want to talk to you because I found out later the reason why they don't want to talk to you is they're so insulated and they feel that if you're not one of them, you're the other. And if you're the other, they're told that the other people want to hurt you or even kill you or destroy you. So they keep to themselves. So I was able to find two people who had left the community who would talk to me. One of them was Beatrice Weber, she lost custody of her 13 kids. She got married when she was 16. She was finally able to see some of her children. And she actually recently, I think it was last year, she sued the city of New York for not having better secular education in the yeshivas. And she won. And she won. And now she counsels, you know, other women. And it's the thing is there's so many different sects and they're all different. But the main thing is this idea that if you're with us, you're safe. If you need money, we'll all gather together and we'll give you money. You want a wedding, you don't have money for it, you can have my wedding dress, you can have this. It's all meant to say the only way you're safe is if you stay in the community. If you go outside the community, it's not only dangerous to you, it's dangerous to your siblings. Because if you do something that causes shame, your siblings will not make a match. and they won't get married, and it'll be terrible. That's like the worst thing ever. And I thought, I just thought that that was so interesting, because on the one hand, there's the pull of everything's taken care of for you. You never have to worry. There's no dark nights of the soul. But on the other hand, you're not allowed to go out in the outside world. You can't read secular books. I mean, the books I saw that they were reading were so, they were really awful. It was things about like a boy who, he went out on the Sabbath and he dropped a coin. And I guess you're not supposed to carry coins on the Sabbath. And he felt really terrible. And then he picked up the coin and he gave it to a homeless person. And they said, well, that was a good thing to do, so that's okay. So the books they read are always sort of lessons. You know, it's nothing like really real or thorny or emotional. I'm just sort of fascinated with it, like how you live that way.
And also for Helen, who's Ella's mother, it is, she breaks from the community. She gets pregnant at a very young age, and she's pretty hell-bent on the fact that this isn't going to be, that the closed life is not going to be the life for her daughter.
Right, right. No, she definitely wants her daughter to be open to all the stuff. And, you know, she remembers that her opening up was when she saw Three Girls in Brooklyn was on the subway, and she grabbed it and she snuck it and she came home and she read it in secret and she thought, oh my God, this is such a great book. I want to know more. And she just quietly went out in the world. It's kind of like, the reason why they don't want you to go out in the world is because you see what's out in the world and you want to see more. There's all kinds of stuff out there. And she definitely wanted that for her daughter.
In the last part of the book, what was it like for you of telling that, of how that would come together, where Ella ultimately has to fess up?
It was really hard to write that. I kept trying to act it out to think, well, what would she say? Like, what would the only reason why she would ever tell the birth mother, the adoptive mother, who she really was if she absolutely had to. And it reached a point where the adoptive mother needed her to be a character witness in court. And Ella knew she can't go to court. She's a felon. First of all, she's still a felon. And second of all, she doesn't want anybody to know. So she had to make a decision, and it ripped everything apart. It just ripped everything apart.
In the end, it seems that you obviously want a satisfying ending, but also there is a child involved here. There's a young life, and you want to, I assume, even as the author, you want to protect the life of that child.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot because I wanted it to be realistic. I didn't want it to be like a Hallmark movie where all of a sudden all three of them hug and say, we're going to be our own family. And I thought about it, and I thought, well, what would I do? What would I be comfortable with doing? Because there's all kinds of issues like this that come on with open adoptions. And I thought, well, I left it open so that we don't know what's going to happen. Maybe the adoptive mother will allow Ella to see her child supervised. Maybe she won't for a while. Maybe she'll wait until Ella is 12 and says, who's my birth mother? Can I meet her? What's going on? I mean, I don't think any of those situations is ideal, but I don't know. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I wanted to leave it open so that Ella has some hope that something will happen. Even just the fact that they're all in Ann Arbor, maybe she'll be able to see her, even if it's just seeing her walking down the street or something, or maybe the mother will change her mind and say, okay, you can have a day with her. We don't know. And there's a lot of literature that says that we don't even really know yet what's really best for the child. It depends on the child, and it depends on the adoptive mother, and it depends on the birth mother. So I like to leave things with what I call a never-ending story, where you close the book and you think, oh, I wonder what's going to happen.
Which is wonderful for us because we get to think about it for days and weeks on end. I thought another aspect to that is that because you make it very clear this initially was a closed adoption, it brings us to this question, and you touched on it a moment ago, of closed adoption versus open adoption and what rights the birth mother and birth parents have versus those who wouldn't. And in this case, it was circumvented, but it does confuse things.
It does. Yeah, I wrote a book about open adoption after my husband and I tried to open adopt after the birth of my son, which was a disaster for us. We were scammed a couple of times. But one thing that I noted was that you can't know how you're going to feel, and nobody tells you that the birth mother is going to be jealous of the adoptive mother, and the adoptive mother is going to be jealous of the birth mother, because you're both sort of vying for this child, and it's really hard to do the right thing for that child. And my whole thesis was like, well, people should really talk about this more. And when I wrote that book, I was actually attacked because somebody said, well, what do you know about it? You have an adopted kid. You don't know what it's really like. And I said, no, I don't. That's what I'm trying to find out. So I think it's still an issue. You have to figure out how you're going to deal with it. Some adoptive parents, after a while, they don't want the birth parents around. And some birth parents, after a while, they feel better not having any contact. And then it's just left up to the child. And everybody's damaged in some way, but I can't think of any better way to do it.
I think as we close up our conversation, I'm going to say this to you, and I mean it as a compliment, so hopefully you take it as such. But it seems to me that you find it fascinating to look at a human who comes out into the world and just how screwed up things can become.
Yes, that's exactly right. I always say that I'm a writer of good people facing horrifying situations.
Especially maybe if it's even a little bit messier than ours.
Right. Yes, exactly. Messier than ours. It can make you feel better.
Carolyn Levitt's latest is Days of Wonder. It is published by Algonquin. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LeDuc. Thanks also to the production support from Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.